Number 12! Blared the voice of Aya Nakajima over the jury-rigged PA system, slicing through their conversation. Miki turned, along with nearly everyone else, to see the diminutive admiral point an accusing finger at Zarg Thalek, who, to his annoyance, was suddenly transfixed by the beam of a powerful field beacon being wielded as an impromptu spotlight by bridge engineer Azrodel, and continue, "The Klingon will now sing!" Zarg scowled at her and replied flatly, "Absolutely not." Captain Krontep leaned over and said in a very loud stage whisper, "Zarg, the Vestai Nakajima is a vice admiral, and she is within 100 kilocams of our engine room besides. You will do as she commands, and you will like it." Zarg scowled more deeply, then replied stiffly, "As you command, Captain." Then he rose, blinked ill-temperedly into the light, and began an exceedingly bad rendition of "My Boyfriend's a Pilot" to Aya Nakajima's unbridled delight. It wasn't a song he'd have chosen, but he had to work with what the band provided. At least it was short. Miki blinked, shook his head, and tuned the Klingon out with great effort, refocusing his attention on Azalin. The Dantrovian had missed the entire exchange, standing there staring down at the floor with horrified eyes. Miki put his hand on her shoulder and said softly, "You've been like this ever since we came here. Edgy, angry. It's..." He shook his head. "It's very upsetting." Azalin studied the pattern of the deck plates beneath her feet for a while, then looked back up at Miki with a troubled look and said, "You're right. I've lost my balance, fallen out of step with my own spirit. I'm holding a grudge. Tvilna Zhai, I'm holding a grudge. For all the things she's done to Katie, for what she did to you, for almost getting a lot of you killed. But that part wasn't her fault. She had no way of knowing they'd react that way. She trailed off, losing herself in thought for a few moments. Then she smiled uncertainly, touching his arm. "Congratulations, Miki. You're a better Dantrovian than I am right now." He put his own hand over hers and looked at her steadily. "What can I do to help you?" he asked. "I don't know," Azalin replied honestly. "This has never happened to me before. I need to go back to Dantrov, I think. Regroup, see my family, climb the trees and sing to the stars. It's been so long since I was home." Miki nodded. "Ask Captain Hutchins to take you home, then," he said. "I'm sure he'll be happy to. At the very least, if he can't pull his ship away from here that long, he has connections. He can get someone else to do it. For that matter, I'm sure Corwin would." She nodded. I'll do that. I will." "Would you like me to come with you? I've been wondering what it would be like to visit Dantrov since I started studying your philosophy." Azalin smiled. "I'd like that. But what about Dorothy? Do you think she would understand?" "Well, let's find out." Miki left her standing where she was, went along one of the tables, and found Dorothy deep in conversation with the Soong brothers. They were an interesting study. Physically, they were all but identical, identifiable only by their different uniforms, but their manners were completely different. Even here in this crowded, noisy, boisterous dining hall, with T'Pol, who had a surprisingly good voice, belting out "Why Do Fools Fall in Love" in the background, Data sat upright, back straight, knees together, feet flat on the floor, and listened with a look of polite interest. Lore, on the other hand, was slouched back against the wall with his feet up on the table, hands folded across his middle. His face was sleepy-looking, and he nodded every now and again to show he was paying attention. Miki borrowed Dorothy from the conversation for a few minutes, promising to return her, and led her back to the corner where Azalin waited. Dorothy listened to the plan, then nodded. "I see no problem," she said. "Are you sure?" Ezalin asked. "I mean, I know that you guys are sort of starting something," she went on, sounding most unlike herself in her discomfort. "I couldn't stand to think that I was interfering with that." Dorothy shook her head. "Not at all. I have much to do in preparation for my Turing Board evaluation." With a faint smile, she glanced at Miki and went on, "I would have had to neglect him for much of the next month anyway." Ezalin grinned. "You've been reinstated, then?" Dorothy nodded. "The board was quite displeased to learn that my application had been fraudulently cancelled as part of a PsyCorp power play. They've issued a letter of formal censure and reconfirmed my appointment for Saturday, June 4th, 4 weeks from today." She cocked her head inquisitively. "Will that be enough time? I would like you both to be present." Ezalin threw her arms around the robot and hugged her tight, then stepped back with something like her old sparkle in her eyes and said, "That'll be fine, just fine. Of course we'll be there. Dorothy, thank you. I can't say how much this means." Dorothy smiled, really smiled, and replied, "Don't let him fall out of a tree and break his neck." "I won't," Ezalin promised. "You should try the fried taquitos," said Dorothy as she led the others back to the gathering. "I'm told they're quite good." A few minutes later, as the entire ship's company of the Hoskaj, even Zarg, plus various others, finished singing the theme from Battlecruiser Vengeance, Griffin got up and banged a serving fork against the side of his ship's issue metal mug. This brought a semblance of quiet to the room, permitting him to speak, with only slight effort, and be heard. "Everyone, your attention, please. Former WPI students especially." That got their attention, all right. They perked up like a town full of prairie dogs reacting to a ground tremor. "I know I've kept you waiting for news, and I'm sorry, but the truth is I only just got all the ducks in a row today, and I didn't want to get your hopes up until I was absolutely sure. I have some information about the status of your school year. First, your awarded finals. I've been in consultation with Dean Montaigne, President Tiefeld, and most of your professors, and the consensus has been that it would be unfair, after the disruptions of the last week, to expect you to complete final examinations for term D05. Therefore, your grades for the term will be computed based on your cumulative performance over the course of the term and posted accordingly. If any of you wish to take the final for a given course anyway, in hopes of bettering your grades, you may do so. But from what I saw, none of you have any particular need to do that." Cheers erupted, both from the students and from the Klingons, who were in such a party mood they were willing to celebrate anyone's good fortune. "Second, next year. With over half the student body departing the solar system and not expected to return, as well as a considerable percentage of the faculty and staff, plus extensive damage to the campus and facilities, the trustees of the Worcester Preparatory Institute have decided that the institute will be permanently closed." That brought a disconsolate hush. They'd all known in their hearts that they wouldn't be able to return, but to hear that the school was closing, that it wouldn't go on without them. "Third," said Griffin with a twinkle in his eyes, "what now? If you'll be so kind as to report to Docking Bay 11 tomorrow at noon, I have a suggestion that I think you'll all like. That's all I want to say about it right now. Sorry, but you get to have a little more suspense. The good kind this time, I hope. For now, relax, enjoy your grades, and have a good time." Krontep jumped to his feet and led his crew in a Klingon song that was basically their equivalent of "For He's a Jolly Good Fellow," only in the plural. In the midst of all the celebration and noise, Utena Tenjo happened to scan the length of the table and spotted something that made her burst out laughing and clout Corwin on the shoulder to get his attention. Corwin turned from his conversation with Captain Picard, looked, and laughed as well. Midway down the head table, Kate was leaning sideways, her head on the shoulder of Juri Arisugawa, who looked not at all discommoded by this fact. The redhead was, in fact, carrying on a perfectly normal conversation with Deanna Troi, neither of them acknowledging that anything was out of the ordinary. In the noisiest room in this sector, surrounded by exuberant classmates and boisterous Klingons, Caitlin Hutchins had fallen asleep. The next day, the duelists and friends, and Liza, who wasn't really their enemy anymore, but didn't fit those categories either, congregated in Bay 11, where dagger disc gleamed, armor, shields, and comm array restored. Griffin, who, they noticed with some interest, was accompanied by a positively gleeful-looking Major Kira Nerys, showed them smilingly aboard, called for launch clearance from Babylon 5, and guided the ship into space. It was a short hop wherever they were headed, only about 15 minutes until the ship's landing gear touched down with a clunk and a hiss. Griffin and Kira came back from the cockpit, still grinning. As they filed down the ramp and stepped off onto the grass, the students noticed the gravity lightening. Moose McEachern, who was by long habit something of an expert on the subject of gravity transitions, guessed it to be about 0.8 G. Pleasantly light even for a normal human, positively buoyant for a Hoffmanite like him, but not light enough to cause normals difficulty in transitioning back to a standard environment. Hoffmanites, bred to adapt to a difference of more than 2 G, had no such difficulties, but normal humans suffered terribly when transitioning back and forth between environments separated by as little as half a standard gravity. The air was warm, pleasant, and fragrant. Dagger Disc was parked atop a grassy hill overlooking what appeared to be a river, which could be seen to flow into a small lake with some mountains on the far side of it. Woods surrounded the area. Off in the distance, nestled at the mountain's base next to the lake, there appeared to be a town. Everything was flooded by Bahava El's very soul-like sunlight. "Welcome to Jurado," said Major Kira. "This is the fifth of Bajor's moons." She pointed at a beautiful crescent planet, about a quarter full, hanging in the sky. "There's Bajor." She pointed again to a spot near the horizon. "If it weren't daylight, Babylon 5 would be right about there." Brushing his hands together briskly, Griffin said, "Now, if you'll just follow me, please." They did so, murmuring among themselves. This was like a field trip. They walked a few dozen yards, then stopped, some with exclamations of awe. Standing at the crest of the hill was a massive gray stone structure like a Moorish castle, complete with crenellations and a dome peaked with what looked like bronze. There was a large circular hole over the broad main entrance, where there had obviously been a window, probably decorative, in the distant past. The place was in great disrepair, having been abandoned some lengthy time ago, but it was impressive anyway, and also pretty. Standing next to the rusty metal-strapped main doors of this edifice was a small group of people. A man in orange robes and a hood, a thinner, elderly man in an Earthman's business clothes, and a slightly stout woman in a green suit. As the students grew near, they made exclamations of recognition, for two out of the three they recognized. President Roland Tiefeld, late of the Worcester Preparatory Institute, smiled and polished his half-moon glasses on his handkerchief. "Children," he said in his somewhat reedy voice, "so good to see you again." Miss Claudia Montaigne, the Institute's former Dean of Student Life, nodded as well. "Hello, everyone. You look well," she said. The questions of the students tumbled over each other in confusion. Smiling, Griffin held up his hands for quiet. "Please," he said. "It'll all make sense in a minute. Everyone, I want you to meet Otano Lompoc. Prylor Otano heads a Bajoran monastery a few miles from here." The man in orange, whom the students could now see, was a fairly elderly Bajoran with a grizzled beard and a pleasant smile, bowed in greeting. "Welcome to Jurado, my friends. Welcome, if you agree to what we are about to propose, to your new home." The proposal was beautiful in its elegance. The former Worcester Preparatory Institute needed a new home, one in a location more politically amenable to its mission of diversity and tolerance. The Bajor system was in the process of flinging its doors open to the galaxy, having volunteered to be the site of the Babylon Foundation's visionary station, a place to bring the peoples of the galaxy together. "It seemed only natural," explained Major Kira, "that the people of Bajor should welcome the youth of the galaxy as well, the leaders of tomorrow as well as the leaders of today, to enjoy the beauty and history of Bajor, a world whose cultural history spanned over 25 millennia." "Selecting a site for the new school wasn't easy," she said. The comment seemed to be part of a joke between her and Griffin, because as she said it, a glance passed between them and they both had to stifle a snicker. "Bajor itself is still rebuilding from the mess the Cardassians made of it while they visited during the War of Corporate Occupation 18 years ago. And Bajor 8, our principal colony in the system, is very remote, not a place for a group of kids as high-spirited as you," she added with a grin. But then the captain had a thought. "That's why he's the captain," she added confidentially. "He said," and here she assumed a rather comical impression of Griffin, which, given the radical differences in their physical appearances, was a bit remarkable in itself. "What about Gerardo, Major?" And I said, "Gerardo? Of course! That's utterly brilliant!" Griffin couldn't take it anymore. He burst out laughing, then waved for quiet and said, Thank you, Major, for showing me how thick you can lay it on. The truth of the matter is that Gerardo was all Major Kira's suggestion. I was totally stumped until she came up with it. There are 5,000 people living on this moon, fully half of them in that one town over there, he pointed, which means there's lots of space. Your nearest neighbors are Prylar Artano and his monks, and they had this site, well, I'll let the Prylar tell this part. Artano nodded in polite acknowledgement, then indicated their surroundings. This area has a climate similar to that of the part of Earth you are accustomed to, he said. It snows in winter, and is quite pleasant in the spring and fall. I'm told, he added with a confidential smile, that the skiing in the mountains across the lake is quite good. At any rate, the area is quiet and well suited to learning and contemplation. My own monastery is located in the next valley over. But at the same time, you would not be cut off from civilization, he added. Port Gerardar is a sleepy town, it's true, but there's quite a good local market there. In addition, there will be regular shuttle service to Bajor and Babylon 5. And of course, those students with Starship Master's certificates will be welcome to bring their vessels. As you can see, we've plenty of parking, said the Prylar with a twinkling grin. After some consideration, said Griffin, we've decided to name the new school the Deedlet Satori Mandeville Memorial Institute, after one of the heroes of the War of Corporate Occupation. Some of you may have heard of her. Nods all around. President Tiefeld can tell you what little we know so far about the academic shape of the new institute. The little old man smiled benevolently and said, We have retained approximately 90% of the faculty, including almost all those teachers who left WPI after term B04. Professor Stuvek? Asked Kate hopefully. Tiefeld smiled again, nodding. The professor was most eager to rejoin us, he said, although, of course, he would claim rather stuffily that his decision is rooted solely in logic. Kate giggled, nodding, and the president went on. Additional faculty will be recruited locally. Prylar Otano's order has several excellent mathematicians and theoreticians, for instance, who are quite eager to assist their new neighbors in any way they can, and the Prylar himself is an accomplished astronomer. Otano smiled modestly. As for student life, said Dean Montaigne, we'll be starting from scratch, which means we'll be able to include a number of things that the old campus, being restricted by the Historical Preservation Act, could never quite get working, like a proper campus center and better assembly facilities for the symphony concerts and the spring formal. We hope to retain all of WPI's best traditions, while at the same time using our unique location and opportunities to forge new ones, It should be a very exciting time. Of course, we're losing a considerable chunk of the student body. Almost none of our Earth-based students will be able to come here with the political climate the way it is. We have received confirmation that a great many of the students we lost at Christmas, much like the teachers, will be back. Chenan? Azalin blurted. Oh, please say Chenan's coming back. Miss Montaigne smiled and nodded. She can't wait, she confirmed. She'll be here next week. She insisted on helping with the construction. Says it's in her family's nature. Chenan, thought Mia, as Azalin gave a celebratory yell. That's a Minbari name. That ought to be interesting. And, of course, we hope that our new location will enable us to recruit many new students. It seems likely that much of the permanent crew of Babylon 5, which will be arriving in the next month or so, will choose to send their children here. There are provisions for educational facilities aboard the station, but given the choice, we think most parents will want their children studying under a blue sky. As such, the Babylon Foundation has provided a generous endowment to the Mandeville Memorial Institute. Utna and Juri shared a grin. Megazone throwing his money where it would do the most good, like always. Prilar Otano? Said Mia.
Yes, child?
Can you tell me anything about this building? She asked, indicating the castle-like ruin they stood before. Otano smiled, though it seemed as if the smile had a touch of sadness in it.
Ah, yes. This building is ancient even by Bajoran standards, he said. We are fairly certain it predates our own colonization of this moon. It's remarkably well constructed, and from what little our archaeologists have been able to glean from it, it seems to have been some sort of temple, we think, or possibly a place of learning. In either case, he added with a smile, it's a lovely sight, and it seemed appropriate to offer it to your institute.
The Prilar looked sadder still and said,
The building's interior is quite dilapidated, of course. The walls are strong, but it has lacked a roof for some centuries. We have learned all from it we can, so there is no real reason to leave it. No doubt you will want to pull it down and replace it with something more modern.
No, said Utna, Mia, and Caitlin simultaneously. Otano looked surprised, but not annoyed, at the interruption.
No?
He inquired. No, said Utna again. She was looking up at the building. Slowly, she approached it, placing her hand against the wall. You said the walls are solid?
As solid as the mountains yonder, said Otano. But as I said, the interior is in ruins.
That doesn't matter, said Kate, following her roommate's lead. There's some kind of power here. Prilar Otano looked impressed.
Several of our mystics have said the same, though none have been able to identify it. It doesn't seem to stem from the prophets, but neither does it seem to be evil. Quite frankly, we've never known quite what to make of the place.
Mia Ausa stood gazing up at the building for several minutes, a look of concentrated thought on her face.
I know this style, she said, but I can't place it. I'll have to check my books when I get them back. You would be answering a great mystery, said Otano appreciatively, if you can solve the riddle of this building.
It stays here, said Kate. Utna nodded. Seconded, she said, then caught Kate's eye. Are you pondering what I'm pondering, Mademoiselle President?
I think so, Mademoiselle Vice President, Kate replied. But this time, you wear the tutu.
Not a chance in hell, Utna replied with a wicked grin. Then they both turned to face the others as if the last part of their exchange hadn't happened.
I take it, Kate said to her father. The plan is to build a new campus on this site?
Griffin nodded. That's the plan, all right. The Wedge Defense Force Corps of Engineers 3rd Battalion are already on their way. Well, this building stays. The Institute Duelist Society hereby claim it as our headquarters. We'll renovate the interior ourselves if the Corps of Engineers will provide materials and equipment. Mia smiled. I like that idea, she said. It'll give us something to do over this summer. Kate turned to address the rest of the duelists. Those of you with plans to go home, don't let this stop you. I'm sure there'll be plenty to do when you get back, but this will be our home. Living quarters and training facilities both for the whole society? Utrina inquired. Sure, said Wakaba, gauging the size of the place with her eyes. It looks plenty big enough. See, Prylar? Said Griffin, grinning. I told you they wouldn't insist we tear it down. Otano nodded with a beatific smile.
The prophets smile on your children, Captain, he said.
They certainly do, said Griffin. They certainly do. The duelists and their friends sat down in the shadow of the mysterious castle, lost in an animated discussion of their plans for the Society's new headquarters. Throughout that conversation, which lasted until the Prylar excused himself and Griffin hustled the others back onto the ship, Amanda and Devlin said little, glancing uncomfortably at each other from time to time. Azalin noticed it, wondered at it, and felt a sense of foreboding about it. The others were too busy planning and dreaming to notice. Until, back in Daggerdisk's crowded wardroom, Devlin broke into the conversation with a diffident, excuse me, but there's something I have to tell you all. They stopped talking and turned as one to face the young telepath with puzzled looks. He stood by the forward hatchway, looking nervous, his hand linked tightly with Amanda's. The Gamelon's face was subdued, an unusual look for her.
Well, first of all, the good news, said Devlin with a weak grin. Amanda and I, well, we're getting married.
He held up his hand, blushing, to ward off the storm of congratulations, and went on in a louder voice to override them.
We don't know just when yet, might not be for a while, but we'll let you know, and we'll expect you all to be there.
Amanda nodded. Do not think that you can escape, she said, the smile on her face putting the lie to her harsh words. If you do not respond to your invitations, you will be hunted down and dragged to the ceremony in irons and chains.
That sounds like it could be fun, mused Azalin.
What's the bad news? Asked Kate in an I'm-afraid-to-ask-but-someone's-got-to tone.
Devlin's face fell.
Ah, well, the bad news is that we won't be joining you at the new school, I'm afraid.
This brought a new storm, this one of protestations, shocked sounds, and repetitions of the word, What? Devlin nodded, his face sad.
I don't want to leave you. You've been better friends to me than I could ever have hoped for. But now that the cat's out of the bag, so to speak, I need training. I have to learn to defend myself, refine the skills that I already know, both in the use of my powers and in general defensive terms. I learned enough to function in society, but compared to the training a psychop gets, it was very much minimal. If I'm to survive, I need more, and I can't get it here.
He paused, as if collecting his thoughts, and went on, So, thanks to Kate's father, starting next week, I'm to be enrolled at the International Police Organization's Telepath Training Center on Jirai. More congratulations, though they were tempered by the sadness of knowing that their friend was leaving them, perhaps never to return.
What about you, Amanda? Are you going to Jirai to be with him? Asked Azalin.
Amanda shook her head.
No, at least not right away.
I must return to Gamelon. I have duties to perform in the wake of recent events. My life has become considerably more complicated." She, too, paused, then looked up at all of them and said, "I want you all to know, before I leave, just how much I have enjoyed my association with you. The life of a princess is generally a lonely one, and you have made mine not so. In your company, I have been able to pretend for 2 years that I am more like a regular person. You have been true friends to me, and I will never forget you. Any of you will find a safe haven in the Gamelon Empire at any time you may need one." She stopped for a moment, sniffed, and dashed a tear from her good eye.
I will miss you."
"You don't have to say it like we'll never see you again," said Wakaba with a smile. "Gamelon's not that far."
Amanda looked up at her, grinning a bit wanly.
"No," she said. "I suppose it is not at that."
After a rather subdued dinner with their friends, from which Liza Broadbank diplomatically absented herself, Amanda and Devlin left aboard the Vengeance in the early evening. After watching the ship leave from the observation gallery at the end of one of Babylon 5's docking arms with the rest, Skaya entered the core shuttle bound for Red Sector and was surprised to find Liza Broadbank there, sitting in the seat opposite the middle doors, looking pensive. Not upset, but definitely preoccupied. Very carefully, he made his way to the seat at right angles to her, eased himself down, and tentatively cleared his throat. She blinked, startled out of her contemplation. Of, he noticed with a lift of his heart, the Jiraiyan charm he'd given her, to glance up at him.
"Oh, Sky," she said. "Hello."
"Elizabeth," said Skye, as formally as he could.
"Okay, I earned that," said Liza. "Listen, I'm sorry I screamed at you the other day. I wasn't really prepared for what you told me about myself."
Skye inclined his crested head. "I doubt," he told her, "anyone truly could be. No apology is necessary. If anything, I should apologize to you for forcing myself into your troubles at such an inopportune time."
"No," said Liza, "don't apologize. It was exactly what I needed to hear. I've read it now over and over again. That last paragraph. What Dr. Bashir thinks could happen to me."
She sighed, reached over, and surprised the Skrang immensely by putting her hand over his.
"Sky, it scares me to death."
Sky recovered from his shock and nodded. "It's a great change that you face," he said. "As great, almost, as that which every Skrang must endure."
"How's that?" asked Liza, looking interested.
"When Skrang are hatched," said Sky didactically, "we are neither male nor female, and so it remains for the first 12 years of our lives. This is not without its advantages. It means we spend our childhoods blessedly free of the confusing gender roles most mammal species must grapple with all their lives. On the other hand, it leads to a great ordeal when the change inevitably comes."
Liza nodded, smiling faintly.
"I was just about to say, puberty must be a bitch."
Sky slapped his tail against the floor, jaws swinging open in a silent laugh. "It is indeed. We call it Kaisa, the Great Change, and it is to human puberty as a tornado is to the swirling of a breeze in a corner. There is nothing in this universe as confused, as quick to anger, as stupidly opinionated, as headstrong, or as lacking in powers of concentration as a Skrang in Kaisa, except possibly a Vulcan in Ponfar. Obviously, for the peace of Skrangish society, something must be done with these creatures, to occupy their time whilst the change does its work, which can take up to a year."
"What do you do with them?" asked Liza, knowing it was expected of her.
"In the old days, we Skrang were the traitors of Barsave," Sky replied, which didn't seem to be much of an answer in itself. "Our riverboats,
Boats is a pale thing to call them, for all that they plied rivers, for they were truly ships, and great ones at that. Our river boats sailed all the rivers of the world, but especially the Mother Serpent, spreading the goods of each land to its neighbors and beyond. Traditionally, youths undergoing Kaisa were sent to the river to work. Their hard duties and the simple, structured lifestyle of a riverboat crew gave them much-needed distractions, and allowed them to put the nervous energy of the change to a constructive purpose. Today, of course, Barsave is a spacefaring world, and the many peoples of Barsave walk among the stars, but none so much as the Skrang. We have adapted our river trading ways to become our world's principal explorers and traders in space. The great houses own fleets of starships which conduct business all over the Alpha Quadrant and beyond. Just as the riverboats in days past, these ships have an ever-present need for young, resilient, not necessarily any too bright, crew members. Liza sighed.
It must be nice. Travel the stars, work, sleep, not have to worry about who or what you're going to become.
She gazed off into the green expanse of the Arboretum, and then, as they passed into the service tunnel at the other end, she said suddenly, "Do they ever take non-Skrang?"
"Pardon?" said Skye.
"Those trading ships, do they ever take non-Skrang crew members?"
"Rarely, but sometimes," Skye replied.
"A non-Skrang generally can't become part of a crew covenant. Our ship's companies often bind themselves into legal communities, almost like families. But others, usually from the other races of Barsave, have been known to work passage aboard Skrangish ships."
"Do you know of any way I could get on one?"
Skye's brow ridge rose, his eyes going wide.
"Seriously, Elizabeth? Life as a, well, basically a cabin boy aboard a Skrang starship would be a much harder life than you're accustomed to. Discipline isn't necessarily brutal. It depends on the captain and her officers. But the work is hard, and the conditions not exactly luxurious."
"Good," said Liza. "That's exactly what I'm looking for. Don't you see, Skye? Everything about my life as I knew it is gone. I can't go back to my family, and what's more, I don't want to. I have to find out about who and what I can be without them to shape me. And if that means doing things the old Liza would never have done, then that's what I have to do. I'm going through a change, maybe not as personally traumatic as Kaisa, but a great change nonetheless."
Skye weighed this, his tail fidgeting while the rest of him remained still and thoughtful.
"I am of the great house Ishkarat," he said after a few moments' thought. "It's within my power to arrange a berth for you aboard one of my house's ships, I think. But before I do that, I must be certain that you truly understand the magnitude of the undertaking. You won't have very much in the way of privileges. You'll have to share your quarters with Skrang, very possibly Skrang and Kaisa. You'll have to learn Skrangish ways, acquire a working grasp of our language, eat our food. It will help that you're female. The old customs die hard, but..." He shrugged. "Shustal, if it's what you truly want, then I'll help you in any way I can."
Liza smiled. "I don't have anything else to do with myself this summer."
"I had thought," Skye observed dryly, "that you might take the idea of hard work in Kaisa as a metaphor, and perhaps apply yourself to the great amount of work that needs to be done on the new institute."
Liza shook her head.
"No, I think Kate and the others will have that under control. They won't need me around. Anyway, I want to get myself sorted out before I try to be around them. I can tell that they don't know how to react to me, and that's understandable, since I don't know how to react to me anymore."
She shrugged. "I think some time apart from everything I've known before is exactly what's needed for all of us."
Skye nodded. "Very well," he said. "I will communicate with my elders and see what can be arranged."
"Thank you, Skye. Thank you
well, for everything.
It is always a pleasure, said Skye, to help a friend.